You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group. www.americantheater.org.
Welcome to Off Script, American Theater's podcast on all things theatrical. I'm Editor-in-Chief Rob Weiner Kent. I'm here with
Russ Denman, Managing Editor.
As of this week, congratulations, Russ, or recently
Yay. Promoted,
and here with
a Deep Tran associate editor.
Cool. So we have a exciting show for you today. We have an interview with Desdemona Chang, Seattle-based director who Deep interviewed when she was at Oregon Shakespeare Festival recently about her interest, just about many things, but about her Winter's Tale mainly. Is that correct?
Yeah, and also being a director of color directing classics.
Right.
Because that was her goal as a career.
Exactly. Well, interesting. So we have that interview later. But first, we have a couple topics. We have a November issue that recently came out with some interesting stories. The purported theme was the art of producing or something along those lines, management, administration, producing. We can talk a little bit about how broadly we define that and then about what that's going to lead to in future coverage. And then we also want to talk about some labor action that's happening. It's part of a mini trend, I guess you might say, in the theater, thinking about compensation and labor issues, including the overtime. But right now, on Broadway, there's actually on Broadway as well, but off Broadway, there's a negotiations right now. We could just dive right into that issue. We're going to have a story about that next week, but there was a story in the Wall Street Journal that just came out. Pia Catton wrote about this fair wage on stage, using it as a hashtag, and that's a movement of equity members advocating for better salaries on off-Broadway theaters. And they're in currently negotiations now. The agreement expires on Sunday. They would like to, I believe the idea is to up the minimum from something like $593. That's for theaters of 100 to 200 seats, give or take, to something like $810, which is, you know, actuarially a big leap. But it's, as they point out, the number that really popped out in Pia Catton's story was $74. It was about what you make per performance if you take out, money for dues and agents' fees and all that, and which is a staggeringly low amount of money. In fact, I think there are theaters in LA under the 99 seat plan who pay close to that. You know, they're not mandated to pay that, but they've often talked about how they pay well above the $25 or whatever $15 minimum for those. And of course, they're apples and oranges. The 99 seat thing is a whole other thing, but it that number really jumped out at me. If you're making $75 a night, that's like a ticket price at a lot of these off Broadway
yes.
theaters, right?
Yeah, a low end ticket price, because yes. off-Broadway shows can start at $90 these days, depending on
they
the
can.
Show.
They put like the Sweet Charity at New Group, yes.
Yeah.
Or Sweeney Todd, what's that going to go for?
That's Sweeney Todd, it's the whole experience, right? At
yes.
the pie shop?
Yeah.
And there'll be food included, right?
And Here Lies Love was like $100, $125.
Right.
So.
I think Sweeney Todd in London, the food was optional.
Okay. I'm trying to remember what it was for when Natasha Pierre and the Great Comet was at the tent.
Right.
$200.
There was a full meal included with that,
yeah,
I guess.
It was $200.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Wow. So what do we think about this? I mean, obviously there's a lot of there's about five or six big theaters that are over the $3.7 million budget size who are part of this negotiation, but also theaters under that size. So there's the Off-Broadway League, and then there's this other league, which whose name is the Association of Nonprofit Theater Companies, or ANTIC, as it's often called. Under budgets under $3.7 million have joined in this negotiation, which is interesting. That they're not trying to do their own negotiation for something lower.
I would, yeah, and. It's interesting to me because when you compare that to the Lort system, the Lort system has different grades depending on the size of the house.
Right.
So the biggest Lort contract would be a Lort A, which is like the Roundabout Manhattan Theater Club.
Sure.
And that would be that's $900. And then it goes down from there depending on how big the house is. Like I'm currently working on a bunch of columns for Backstage about different Lort theaters. And it's surprising to me like some place like the Wilma in Philadelphia is like a, was it 300 seat house?
I don't know.
Like they're a Lord D, and so which I believe the minimum for that would be 600, but I need to double check my facts.
Right, right.
Or Russ can do it because he has his computer. But it's interesting when you contrast that if you're an actor and you live and work in New York, like you have to pay rent in New York, you have to pay taxes, and we have not disproportionately really high city taxes
right
in New York City, which goes towards great things like civic events and things like that. But if you want to work in the regions, it's actually a better value because you're getting at the most $900 and there's free housing on top of that. And so,
and also cheaper cities to live often.
Exactly. Often. Exactly. And so when you're thinking about, like, I've been watching these videos at Fair Wage on Stage, which is like the grassroots activist, group trying to convince these theater companies about why it's necessary. Mm-hmm. And I'm hearing all these stories from like Kathleen Chalfant and Jessica Hecht and Andrew Garman about, and Stephen Boyer about how you make more money off of unemployment than you do being an actor off Broadway. Mm-hmm. And there's something slightly uneven about that. And so like, why is it the rate is more reasonable for Lort theaters versus an off-Broadway theaters? And what is, for me, what is the argument on the off-Broadway contract side of not paying your actors comparable to what they would be paid in the regions?
Well, I mean, certainly, I've never actually seen this spelled out. I think there's a sources in the story in Wall Street Journal say that from the producer's side, and I've heard this anecdotally from actors and people who work in New York, directors as well, that there's a sort of New York cut that's taken out. That the idea is working off Broadway, working on a New York stage at all, has great career value because of reviews, because of exposure. And I don't think anyone sits at a table and asks people to take, maybe they do sit at a table. From this article, it sounds like they do sit at a table and say, look, take less because it's New York. But I think the competition, plus the idea that it's a this great place to get exposure and have your career explode and go somewhere, is the argument for why the wages are depressed from what they would be in the regions where, you know, those theaters are all have their support and their funding, and they aren't necessarily richer, but also it's also probably cheaper to run a theater, you know, and the real estate is cheaper.
Perhaps unless you're running a theater in San Francisco, Berkeley Rep's a Lort B, and they pay $800 and $900.
It's interesting, yeah.
Oh, but I pulled up the facts. The lowest Lort contract is a Lort D, which is $618. Highest is Lort A, which is $963.
And these are the minimums.
Yes.
Okay. Right. 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 I mean, some of this goes to the heart of what a nonprofit theater is supposed to be doing. Now there are for-profit off-Broadway producers who are part of this as well. But I've always wondered about equity defining things by seat size rather than budget.
Yeah,
because seat sizes
so
seems
weird
to be based on a revenue model, which is like, well, you're selling that many tickets. And, you know, it's not negligible the difference that even a nonprofit can get between a smaller and a bigger house. But look at a place like the Signature where ticket price is not irrelevant, but it has been heavily subsidized because that's a priority. Why should you be paid less in a smaller signature space rather than a larger one when the ticket price is the same?
Yes.
There's a slightly higher volume. It's true. I wonder if that's I'm not trying to throw stones at equity at this point. I'm just wondering if that's the best way to scale these things. I think budget size might be a better way. And this is informed by my thinking about the 99 seat debate
because
that there are theaters there that have budgets well over a million, but as long as they stay under 99 seats, you know, I know equity wants to change that, but I think the seating thing is a weird fixation that might.
Yeah, because then it incentivizes theaters to keep the house small in order to get pay people less, even if they're doing like high profile shows like Soho
Rep. Of course, for commercial production, that's not much of an incentive. That's the idea of keeping the cap. As a commercial production, like you don't want to keep, you want to have more volume. But
I'm wondering, like, why? Yeah, it's interesting. Like, I don't know much about the off-Broadway equity contract in terms of the differences between the larger off-Broadway houses, commercial off-Broadway versus like the not-for-profit off-Broadway versus the lower off-Broadway, like places that small, that's smaller than Playwrights Horizons, for example.
It's true. We're getting into territory we don't know that much about. I do know that nonprofit Broadway houses have a better or lower rate than for-profit Broadway houses. I'm pretty sure that that's the case.
Though I heard that it's not that much lower. Comparable.
Yeah. It's comparable, right.
And I'd imagine that using seat capacity as a distinction would influence programming, because you probably do different shows depending on the configuration of your space.
Yeah. I mean, that goes to mission too also, right. Like what kind of work you want to basically subsidize when you're a nonprofit theater. I mean, that's a side issue. I don't want to distract with that. I think the argument is very similar to the one we've heard about small theater in Los Angeles. Like, there'll be, if you make us pay more, there'll be less of this. There'll be less groundbreaking, experimental, blah, blah, blah work. And of course, actors are saying, well, that's great, but we shouldn't go broke. We shouldn't subsidize this exciting experimental work with our own cheap labor. Like,
right.
In some cases, the math works out to below minimum wage. And that also makes me wonder about New York minimum wage, which is going to be $15. Is that correct? As of, I'm not sure when the date is.
Fact check that.
And there's a lot of, there's whatever the New York facts are, there's a movement toward that, a national minimum wage of 15. And I'm not sure what our profession, where they're going to stand in relation to that, the overtime laws. I mean, this is a trend which we're keeping an eye on. Workers in our field demanding fair compensation and not being asked to give it up for the art of it.
It is $15.
It is $15 as of now.
As of?
We should know this, but
we don't.
No, it's interesting that all of this is happening right now, like the fair wage on stage conversation, 99 seat conversation, the overtime law conversation. Mm-hmm. It seems like there's a movement. It's like the chickens coming home to roost. Mm-hmm. Of this industry has been built, you know, for good or for bad, on the backs of people willing to take low paying jobs. Mm-hmm. And to have day jobs, substantive right. day jobs.
Right.
And so I think now the conversation in the industry is whether that's going to be sustainable, especially when we're talking about all these other topics we want to, you know, we want to tackle, such as getting a more diverse generation mm-hmm. into the theater, and whether right. or not it's sustainable if they're expected to work for free or to work on food stamps.
Right, right. Yeah, and it should be pointed out also that I think the theater, especially the nonprofit theaters, is always going to be a place where people don't make tons of money, but because what they're asking for is not a huge...
No,
It maybe seems like actuarially a huge increase to the theaters, of course, but to the actors, it's going to be just enough to get by. So it's just like making a basic standard of a living wage seems to make sense.
Right. Well, and also adjusting for inflation, too, because this contract's been in place since 2012, and living costs in New York increase substantially every single year. Taxes increase. And so, but the amount that actors and directors and stage managers are paid mm-hmm. haven't.
Well, they did get a pay raise a year ago, but only 2.7%. That was the last negotiated pay raise. So that's like just a cost of living. So it's small. And I don't know what it was or how often that has happened, but yes, Russ.
And just for context, the goal is to gradually increase to $15 an hour minimum wage in New York State.
Right, yeah, of course.
So it's...
All the minimum wage things don't lock in immediately, like in Seattle and elsewhere.
It depends on type of business and such.
Yeah, but it's one of those things where you make more money doing literally anything else versus doing theater.
Well, most anything else. I mean, not literally anything else, but figuratively.
You know, like, or it could be worse. You could be a poet or a visual artist.
Or a
musician. Or a musician. Hello.
Or a musician. Or they're all bartenders.
Okay. I alluded to the fact that there was a Broadway action as well, and this is the first I've heard of it. It was a press release I got yesterday that Teamsters Local 817 is representing Broadway casting directors who, according to the press release I haven't done any reporting on this, it's just a press release that came. That cast directors are currently the only creative people on Broadway who are without basic health care and pension benefits. So
people still get pensions?
Well, with the unions, yes. Uh-huh. I guess Yahtzee and Equity have contribution to health and pension. Casting directors, you know, this was a sort of a mini cause when I was at Backstage West. They were some of the smartest and most interesting people that I've talked to when I was at the Actors Paper Backstage West. And there was talk about unionizing the Casting Society of America, and also, getting them an Oscar nomination. But, you know, in a former life, casting directors were one of my, one of the areas I considered, interesting. So it's interesting
Anything about the Broadway Actors Negotiations?
No.
No?
I don't know what deadline that's on. I haven't heard anything about that.
Interesting.
So, the only thing about Broadway we've heard is the negotiations about Hamilton, the Hamilton stars, and what precedent that will set for profit sharing.
No, but I've been just so inspired by these videos that have come out, because I feel like it's just... like, everyone knows that it's you go into theater and you have to accept that you won't get paid very much. Yeah. That's just the reality of it. But I think people love the art, mm-hmm. and I'm really inspired that they're actually speaking up for the value of the artist.
Yeah,
and
I agree.
And
I just saw Sweat on Saturday, and it's Lynn Nottage's play, which articulates, among other things, of a pretty strong pro-union stance. And I was thinking, the public is one of the theaters in this negotiation, and I wonder if any of those actors have made videos. In fact, they have. Joanna Day has done one of the Fair Wage on Stage videos. David Cromer, who has performed and directed, is directing The Band's Visit at the Atlantic, which is another one of the theaters in this group. So I guess I'm encouraged that folks are coming forward who are actually right now employed at these theaters, seeking employment with these theaters. There's no, like, fear of, as far as I know, of a reprisal or anything.
Well, especially for someone like Stephen Boyer, you're Tony nominated, so relatively you have a little bit more power, or Kathleen Chalfant, and so it's just great to see all of these,
I mean,
like, more established actors, like, speaking up for people who don't have as much power.
Okay. Yeah, I think their power is pretty relative. I mean, Tony nomination is that 250 buy a cup of coffee. You know, it's like what does that? I mean, it's true that they are names and worthy. And what is sobering is to see people like that, or Robert Stanton, people that you've seen work for decades, and you've seen them on TV, you've seen them do all kinds of things. For them to come out and say, "We can't make a living doing this," is very bracing. Elizabeth Marvel, Bill Camp, there's tons of them.
My favorite so far was, I'm not going to name any names, but the cast of A Crazy Ex-Girlfriend made a video.
Right.
And one of them, Gabrielle Munez, she plays one of the roles in that show. Mm-hmm. And she was talking about how perhaps have a fundraiser for artist salaries rather than a fundraiser for $1.5 million lounge. I appreciate the subtle digs at certain theaters, but there is a priority. It's easier to get money for real estate.
Yeah, but if you're talking about Roundabout there, that's actually that fund that was misreported, you know.
Oh yeah, no, it was misreported, but it's going towards musical theater
right.
development. Though right. I'm wondering, like, what in that allocation of musical theater development is what where is all that money going
out.
To?
It's Michael Kors gift. They didn't spell it out. I mean, it could also be aimed at the public and their big renovation, right?
That too, or aimed at the fleet.
Or Atlantic did a big renovation. I mean, these are the debates. I do think, I don't want to cast aspersion on any of these theaters. I do think that, as I've said before in this podcast, as Jim Houghton's passion was ticket prices and removing that barrier, I think there needs to be someone with that kind of mission orientation toward compensation of artists and making that part of their nonprofit mission, because I think a lot of people give lip service to it, and they're good on a lot of fronts. They're good on equity, diversity. They're generally good by industry standards on compensation, but there is clearly there's a gap here between what the intentions are and the goodwill and what is actually being negotiated and paid. So
and just transparency, even just because Fair Wage on Stage had to make these big memes saying we get paid $513. That's not common knowledge at all.
$513 or $593?
Whatever.
$593. Right. Well, it's not common knowledge. It's not hidden. That's public record, right? It was to the theater printed in their programs.
Probably, though. I would love it if most theaters.
Foundry Theater does print their budgets in every program, but they were told by Equity they could not print individual actors, what individual actors were making, which is what their what their impulse was to say, here's what they're all making. But that was Equity's decision. I think that's not an unfair one.
Yeah.
To like talk about, you know, what every actor's getting. I mean. I don't know.
Oh, just actors in general.
Right. No, yeah, that's what
they do have the act.
What they do is that they're able to break out the line that says, here's what we spent on actors total. Yeah. We're not going to, and you do the math. How many actors are there? You might assume that some are getting a little more. They might have made a deal. I don't know.
Now, the interesting thing is Flux Theater, which is run by Gus Schulenberg at TCG, they have a thing on their program because, you know, they're non-for-profit and it's mostly pay as you will for tickets.
Right.
They have a listing on the program that says, this is what we're paying our artists right now.
Mm-hmm.
And if you give us this amount, then we can pay our artists this much.
Right, right.
And so it's a really transparent way of maybe guilt tripping a little bit, but showing audiences like where exactly their money is going to.
I think I'm all for that. I feel like the nonprofit mission, the idea that the nonprofits have a mission that's not tied to a capitalist bottom line is really important to emphasize on all kinds of fronts, new work, diversity, and compensation. And having a nice building is not a bad thing either if you want to have good audience, you know, experience, but like.
Yeah, more holistic.
Yeah, holistic.
Allocations of resources.
And the whole situation with funding is very complicated as well, because often those monies are designated
for they're tied to certain things.
Certain things.
Well, that's why I think if you had someone who made the case, as many people have made very well for new plays, have made for young artists, for diversity, if you had someone make the case for compensation and for retention, and compensation not just of the artists, but of the staff, everyone working, giving their lives to this. Well, that I think is a decent segue to the way that our Art of Producing special issue, the November issue, some of these issues, our themes sort of come from stories that were pitched. So we had a Q&A with Harold Prince, or Hal Prince, as he's universally known, who is really justly known for directing great musicals, Fiddler Cabaret,
Sweeney Todd.
Phantom, Sweeney Todd, like iconic company, iconic musicals. He really should be known as a director, but he started as a producer, and he still thinks a lot like a producer, which I mean is the highest compliment. So I thought he would be a good person. We had a couple other stories floating around about producing and managing, and I thought, well, let's put it into one issue. And so it all happens to also be the issue where we have a report on our Theater Facts, which is an annual report of the fiscal survey of all of our entire of our theater membership and how they're doing. And I don't think I can boil it down, Devin Smith's piece to what it is, but basically theaters are doing okay. They could do better. It's a consistent
trend.
It's interesting that I did note in her Theater Facts report that payroll is the biggest expense at theaters.
Yeah.
So staff, salary, and personnel is the biggest expense. Just leaving that there. It's interesting to note that.
Well, it's going to become even bigger with.
Yes, it is. And I'm wondering if that reflects some of the budgeting they're doing. Anyway, so the Hal Prince interview is great. Online, we also have a great speech he gave about the need for really creative producers, not just investors. That's been very popular online. But we also took the opportunity to fold in some other stories. There's one by Brandon Wallace, who's a professor of theater management, to talk about.
And a producer.
And a producer. Yeah, and a producer as well. I believe he also used to work. We used to work for Equity, so he's been on all sides of the business. About what nonprofit and for-profit producers and managers can learn from each other, and how the roles are different, how they're similar. There's some great folks in that story, Mara Isaacs, and some of the folks who produced Memphis at a couple nonprofits and brought it to Broadway. It doesn't really go into the controversy about nonprofits and commercial, that relationship. He's just more taking it like. They're often called managing directors in the nonprofit world. What do they have in common with producers? What are the cultural and economic differences? And what can students of management learn? I mean, it's probably good to learn both sides of that divide. And then also a piece on Portland, Oregon's Artist Repertory Theater joining LORT, which was a big deal.
Yeah.
A survey of a couple of other theaters, small theaters, more or less in the 100 seat range, buying their own space and trying to expand without, you know, busting up their organization. And, you know, it's growing pains can be it's our theme for a lot of theaters.
Yeah, especially because, like, and after this article about theaters buying spaces came out, we heard that the Bedlam Theater in Minneapolis, yeah, like, they had to close their new facility of 2 years because they couldn't afford it.
Yeah.
And so it's a risk.
A lot of moving out and moving in right now.
But I'm browsing through Theater Facts right now, and I really like the way it was written this year, because there's some really handy headers or, you know, summaries for the beginning of each section of this article. And the last one is, theaters are hiring more artists, but there is a widening gap between artistic and administrative payroll, with, you know, admin growing 22% in the last 10 years and artists growing 8%.
Right. Okay.
So it's relevant to what we've all been talking about in this episode so far.
And all links back. Yes.
And community engagement was a big theme of this report as well.
This is true. So check it out. We should also look for, there's a new column that's going to be starting. The Art of Producing package has a couple other stories related to it. And Stephen Bird and Aaliyah Jones Harvey, there's a profile of them. They're going to be honored at our gala in a few weeks. And we're going to start a regular monthly column, tentative title, Making It Happen. That title is because we're basically want to talk to producers, managing directors, and assorted administrators about why they make so much more than artists. No, about their theaters and about the challenges they face and their side of the aisle, if you will, on their trade. And it's an area that we often don't talk about. We will write about directors, write about actors, write about playwrights. We don't often write about producers and administrative staff and managing directors, development directors. This is the column where we're going to deal with those nuts and bolts issues as best we can. So you can look for that in the coming months. Susie Evans, who's not present at the podcast today, she'll be curating that.
I'm also curating the February issue, which is going to be about artist compensation.
Right. So, yes, look for that as well. Stories online at the end of January, I believe, right?
Yeah. And so if you have any, we know what we're thinking of covering, but if you have any tips to how theaters are investing in better paying their artists and how they're doing it, or artists, admin, you know, everyone, then please send me an email.
Great.
And not about compensation, but if you didn't get enough Halloween last weekend or earlier this week, you can check out my stories of Phantoms of the Theater, ghost stories from far and wide.
It's a really good piece. That's online as well. And it's a really complete piece in itself, but it's like seeking more stories. So we'll stay on the theater ghost beat as best we can. Russ will.
Yes, that's right. So if you have another that you'd like to share, you can find those channels in the story.
Cool. Let's move to our interview with Desdemona Chang. Anything you need to do to set it up, Deep?
Nope.
Is the fact that her parents named her Desdemona, does that have something to do with her interest in classics?
I was wondering.
It has to do with her mother's interest in classics.
Right, sure.
Yeah, well, you'll find that out.
I'll find out in the interview. That's great. Can't wait.
We look forward to it.
I mean, this is my first time at OSF, and it's not easy to get to.
No. Did they do New York, San Francisco, Medford? Or did you do New York, Seattle, New York,
Denver? I did New York, Salt Lake City.
Salt Lake City, okay. Yeah, there's only three airlines that fly into. It's like, you get United, Delta, or Alaska.
Wow.
And then
you don't get many options.
And then the crazy random like Allegiant Airlines flight that takes you, this like happens like twice a week. But yeah, it's like, you know, you've been to the airport. It's like, oh, there's only six gates.
Yeah,
it's a farm airport.
What? Yeah. Do you ever drive up here?
If I'm working in San Francisco, I'll drive because there's no. I mean, it's because Alaska does a great flight between Seattle and Medford.
Yeah.
So when I'm in Seattle, I can do the round trip super easy. But when I'm, if I'm working in San Francisco, then I just drive, and I do it less often.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is a 5-hour drive from San Francisco.
Yeah. I mean, it could be worse because I used to, I sometimes went up to San Francisco from LA when I was in school there. Uh-huh. And it's like a 6-hour drive.
Yeah.
It's like a good weekend trip and it doesn't kill you.
Yeah. And then you just put a few podcasts. You like play Hamilton once. Play Hamilton like once and a half or like almost twice and you're good. Right?
Yes. So. Especially if there's traffic, maybe you'll get to listen to Hamilton three times.
Yeah. So in some ways, it's not as bad. And you just get used to, you just start to understand like, oh, I should leave before this time to miss, to so I can skip rush hour.
Yeah.
You don't want to get stuck in like rush hour traffic or, but that's the only, I mean, you know, you kind of figure it out.
Yeah. Well, what I really want to know is, were your parents Shakespeare fans or how? Do you get the name Desdemona?
No, my recording?
Yes.
Okay. So this was just a casual chit chat then.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. I was like, I always have to like say hello. Thanks for having me on the podcast.
Nah.
Blah, blah, blah. Okay. So the story of how I got my name is a really, interesting one. Are you down with the story?
Yes.
Cool.
Yes.
So, this is what my mom told me. And so I'm kind of spreading it. And if there's any inaccuracies, you can blame her for it. But when my mom, you know, I was born in Taiwan.
Yeah.
So my mom was raised in Taiwan and, you know, she grew up, during the 50s and 60s, at the time there. And, you know how in America you like take the SATs and you apply to college and you get in and there's a whole admissions process. Well, in Taiwan, it was like a government sanctioned or a government run system where all the high school students would take a placement test and based on your score, you were placed in an institution. And, so we didn't really have a choice, like what you wanted to do. And oftentimes you were placed in like vocational schools or trade schools.
Okay.
And so if you were, if
very
you
scored, practical.
Yeah. So if you, they would test you on certain things, you know, like math and like writing or, you know, and then based on your score, if you scored in like the top 5%, you went to engineering school, and the next 5%, you went to like, you know, a different kind of school. And so it had nothing to do with what you wanted to do, but all had to do with like how you scored on this particular test.
Yeah.
And it's crazy because it would like make or break your life, right? If you didn't pass, you just didn't go to college.
But how did they pick like what school you'd go in, you would go to? Is it because of the results of the exam?
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's like an exam based like placement system.
Okay.
And like you had, it was crazy because you would have these test results posted on like City Hall.
Dang.
Like, announced on the radio. And
that's not high pressure at all.
No. And also like you had, my mom had friends who were like black market test takers who would, you know, like, oh, I'll just, you know, we look alike. Give me your ID. I'll pretend to be you. You tell me what score you want and I will get it within that range. Cause you'd be like, okay, get me this score. I don't want to be so good that they know that I cheated, but it can't be so bad that I fail. So they would ask these test takers to take the test for them and they would sort of just get that taken care of.
Yeah.
Anyway, so my mom, who is reportedly, you know, by her own account, a really bad test taker. She's horrible at taking tests. And so she took this test and she scored really, really poorly. She passed. She was able to go to school, but she scored really, really poorly and she was placed in theater school.
Okay.
So like the lowest ranking people were placed in the National School of Theater. And so that's what happened to her. She wanted to be a journalist, right? She wanted to go into like communications and broadcasting and be a journalist. And instead she got placed in theater school. And so she's like, okay, I guess I'm going to spend the next 4 years doing plays. And so she spent her next 4 years in college making costumes, acting on stage, doing all kinds of tech stuff. And one of the things that she did was a production of Othello. And so she read the play and she wrote from the play and she thought, oh, if I ever have a daughter, I'll name her Desdemona. And that's why I got my name.
That's morbid, no?
Oh, well, that's what I thought. Like when I was 9, I read the play.
Yeah.
And it took me forever to get through because I had no idea what the words were about. And when I finally figured out the plot of the play, I went to her and I said, why did you name me Desdemona? She dies at the end. And she was like, you're missing the point. That's not the point. The point was that she was virtuous and she was, you know, she held her ground. She wasn't a weak character. And it's not about the fact that she dies. It's because she was awesome. And I was like, oh, okay. But, so that's how I got my name. Because my mom was forced to go to theater school. when she was in Taiwan. And, you know, after she graduated, she ended up working for a magazine and ended up becoming a journalist eventually. Good. Anyway.
Good.
And so when I told her, you know, I was like, oh, I'm taking a drama class in college and I might think of doing a theater major. She's like, no, why? Why?
Why is this doing that?
Why? Right. It's like, and then I was like, well, you went to theater school. She said, no, I didn't choose it. They made me because I was a horrible test taker. Why would you choose to be in the bottom? Don't choose to be in the bottom. You're so smart. You can be a lawyer. You can be a doctor. And I was like, yeah, but I'm happy doing this, you know? And so, I feel like that's just kind of how it is with, I mean, I don't know. I don't want to make any assumptions about, you know, being raised in an Asian family and expectations and whatever, but it was definitely, that was definitely like, you know, being an artist had a bit of a, you know, it just wasn't something you would be proud of announcing to your family. And so there was always a little, you know, my mom was just waiting for me to like, for this to work out, right? Like, please let this work out. Please let this be something that I can brag about, you know, to my friends, I guess. And she actually flew out to Ashland a few months ago to come see Winter's Tale.
Oh, yeah.
And I think she was just really, I think she was quite taken by this community. She showed up and she said, oh my God, it's so cute. Everything is so cute. So, she's happy. Yeah. She keeps making, like, she keeps asking when I'm going to Broadway. And I feel like, well, that's not really a marker of success, but I don't know. Mom, whatever. Whatever they want me, I'll go. Sure. Sure.
Well, I think, like, well, in my experience, it's not like Asian parents don't want you to be in the arts, but if you're going to do it, like, you need to get to the top.
Yeah. You know, it's so funny. That's so true. Like, I took piano lessons when I was, you know, a kid. Like, when I was 5, I started taking piano. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't great, but I was decent. Like, I would practice, and I was decent at playing piano. And I remember my mom telling me, like, oh, someday you'll go to Carnegie Hall. I can, like, send you to Juilliard. And I was, like, 6-year-old wondering, what's Juilliard? What's Carnegie Hall? But I should totally go there because my mom really wants me to go there. I think it's really interesting how there's this kind of, if you're going to do it, then...
Don't be mediocre at it.
Yeah, like, be at the top of your game, I guess. But I also feel like... Boy, oh boy, there's something also called realistic expectations. Especially if you know that I wasn't gifted. I was just like a pretty okay piano player. I wasn't like Yo-Yo Ma, you know, playing for JFK when he was 3 or something like that. You know, so yeah, it's really interesting.
Well, I'm not seeing A Winter's Tale until a little bit later in the week, but I've been really excited about it. Well, mostly because of the costuming.
Yay.
A big fan of that particular period of costuming.
Oh, cool. Have you had a chance to see, like, photos?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Like the white and, like, the head pieces. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But it's also, because I was talking to Rob about it, and there's not that many treatments of Shakespeare set in Asia. And when there is, there's yellow face. There's yellow face involved. And so did you think about that when you were... doing your version of...
Yeah, I mean, you know...
In response to...
One of the things we had talked about, I mean, early on was if OSF is really interested in this conversation around representation, inclusivity, and doing an Asian Shakespeare, which was how this whole conversation started. And it's no secret that the leading edge for this production was an interest in being more inclusive. In terms of representing different cultures and looking at Shakespeare through different lenses, right? Mm-hmm. And OSF has this wonderful tradition of embracing other cultures in how they represent Shakespeare. And so early on, you know, there was conversations around, oh, it'd be interesting to look at an Asian Shakespeare in 2016, what that would mean, right? And so then the larger issue is how, why, for whom, what's the purpose? Right. And it was, you know, we were on the heels of the Nightingale craziness and like the Mikado was kind of resurfacing as a really uncomfortable thing. And it felt like, I don't know, it felt like the right time to seize upon something that was about, listen, we're going to do this. Let's do it with the folks in charge being Asian. Right. Like, there's something to be said about, when we talk about representation, we usually talk about the faces we see on stage, mm-hmm. and we rarely talk about the people who are making the decisions that led to those people being on stage, wearing what they're wearing, doing mm-hmm. what they're doing, right? So it was really important to me that, you know, for example, like you said, the costuming, that I wanted an Asian costume designer. And so we had talked about that. I wanted to have, you know, as many Asian people on board in the creative team. And so when we had decided on, you know, and Helen Huang, who's a costume designer, she and I had talked about, you know, this idea of the play being half set in an Asian context and half set in a Western context. And it took us a while. We circled through several versions of what those contexts were. I knew that the play was going to be about an old and a new, a winter and a spring, summer, kind of a play that was polarized in two parts. Mm-hmm. And that somehow the ancient fairy tale winter part was the eastern part, and the more contemporary, or the more I guess modern, was going to be the western part.
Yeah.
And we had talked about several, are we talking about, you know, which dynasty of China? Like I'm Chinese, and so it felt like the most intuitive path was to talk about the play through, I guess, a Chinese lens, or at least a launching point from that.
Well, a specific right. Chinese lens, too. I mean, I don't remember the time period that you're setting it in, but
it's yeah, like, we had talked about it being Han. Okay. Yeah. Because we had, you know, Leontes's kingdom is one of peace, right? This idea that he goes off on this jealous tirade, and the whole idea of him being a tyrant is abnormal, right? It's once upon a time, there was a king and a queen. They ruled in peace until one day this crazy thing happened.
Yeah.
Right? Until one day he's infected by this jealousy that no one can explain. So, you know, and Helen said, well, you know, we're going to talk about periods of China of great prosperity, of great peace, of, you know, Han is a perfect time of that. It's when a lot of people think about it as China's golden age. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. And it's like, you know, it was set in 200 AD or around that era. It was also mm-hmm. the beginning of the Silk Road, where yeah. you saw, you know, flourishing of trade. And so that became our departure point, you know. And the conversations around, are we looking at representing Han in a very literal way, or are we talking about Han inspired? And I had initially thought that it would be, you know, more useful to look at it as a, you know, I wanted to represent it as faithfully as I could. Yeah. But then once we started talking about casting and the reality of casting, and I said, look, I'm going to have a lot of mixed race Asians in this production. I'm going to have East Asian, South Asian. And it felt like something larger than just saying that this was China, right? Mm-hmm. And so we dug a little deeper, and it became, so our world of Cecilia became more about a Han inspired, you know, ancient Eastern kingdom, right? If we can imagine that there was ever a Pangaea Asia from which we're all descendants, mm-hmm. That would be the kingdom of Cecilia, right? So we can understand how we would have a South Asian Paulina, and a mixed race Leontes and a Korean American playing Hermione, that it's not actually about representing literal China, but using that sense of ancientness, easternness. And it's tricky because you're going to get into a lot of dangerous waters about, oh, well, then aren't you just appropriating? Aren't you just borrowing and picking? And I would say on some level, yes. But I think there's also, you know, it's what was largely more important to me was the conversation around those choices, as opposed to making assumptions about, oh yeah, that just looks Chinesey.
Yeah.
Right. And there's a lot of interrogation, you know, that Helen and I had made, that we had talked to the actors about, that Gina Pizzasal came in as a dramaturg, just a thorough interrogation of what we were doing with the style and the world we were creating. Mm-hmm. Just because I had the feeling that this production would be somehow, you know, I guess scrutinized, maybe? Maybe scrutinized is a bit too harsh of a word. But I knew that this was a production that would be looked at and measured up against other productions that have been less successful at representing, you know, Asian-ness.
Yeah, like a model for other productions, too, I would think.
Right? Yeah. So you kind of, so in some ways, I don't know, it's just doing your due diligence. And mm-hmm. and being really, really not even careful. I don't even want to say it was careful, but just being smart about why and how, and does this have to be that? Are we doing this because we think that's how it is? Are we borrowing from Hollywood? Are we, right? Because we are a group of people in 2016 doing this play. None of us were there in at the Han Dynasty when any of this was set historically. Yeah. And anything we see, anytime we see history represented, it's always through someone's lens, whether it's art or a movie or a painting or a play. None of us were there, you know? So even when we see, like, you know, 12 Years a Slave or Roots or any film that is set historically, it is always through a lens of a storyteller or a narrative or some kind of narrative. You know, it's curated history. So I think understanding that that's what that is. And even when you look at research, based on historical periods, even that's curated in some ways. So, we've sort of embraced that as the reality that there's multiple narratives inside how we represent Asian-ness, how we're going to represent Asian-ness in the context of Shakespeare, given that Shakespeare has a legacy, Asian-ness has a legacy. And right now in 2016, we are in this current intersection of many conversations about what is responsible representation on stage. So I don't know. Right. I mean, I think some folks will see it and love it. And some folks will see it and think it's terrible. And some folks will see it and kind of be confused by it. And I think all of those opinions and viewpoints are legitimate. Yeah.
It's, well, and just to be really pithy about it, like, you can't, if you're Taiwanese, like, you can't appropriate yourself.
Right.
So if anyone can play around with those tropes, it should be someone of that same background. And anyone who isn't, like, as you said, you do your due diligence.
Right.
Because, like, did you read that Lionel Shriver? She wrote a speech about how appropriation is, she hopes that it's a fad because it makes it so that writers and creators cannot think outside of themselves for fear of being accused of appropriation and being criticized.
Right, right, right.
And castigated and all of those things. But I feel like the conversation around it is, like, it's not like a black and white, you can do this versus you cannot do this.
Right. You can do whatever you want. I mean, honestly, like, it's a free world, and at least it's a free country here in America. And as art makers, you can do whatever you want, and you can appropriate if you want to, but don't be surprised if there's backlash, right? And so part of me even doing this kind of understands there's sensitivity around it. Well, if she can make up Asia, how come I can't make up Asia? Right? So that, I don't know if I have a fair answer for that, other than I feel like, well, you can, you know, but if you do, you might get backlash from the Asian community. So, and I might get backlash from people. I don't know. I haven't yet, fortunately. Mm-hmm. I haven't gotten any hate mail. And I feel like it's such a tricky territory because we all come at this from a different lens and we all have different legacies, and I don't know. Is self-appropriating a thing? I don't know. I mean, is it my biology or my culture that entitles me to claim, right, an identity? What is it if I, you know, my friend, Lauren Yee, the playwright, of course, who's lovely and writes plays, always challenging notions around race and identity, doesn't speak a word of Chinese, is fourth generation. You know, grew up in San Francisco, and they're like, "Oh yeah, you're that." And she's like, "People think I have this immigrant identity, and I don't. I'm not the boba tea kid that grew up." You know,
nothing wrong with boba tea.
Nothing wrong with boba tea.
But there's something about, like, you know, the assumptions you make about, like, "Oh no, I'm actually not bilingual. I don't have an immigrant background. My parents came to America by way of Mexico. They were like Chinese Mexican."
Whoa.
So it's, you know, so her story is really interesting too, because it's like, well, but at the same time, I feel like there's an assumption that I have to fill a particular niche, or that I naturally represent a certain demographic, right? And so she's like, can I claim that? Because I look that way, even though I that actually isn't my life experience? I don't know.
So I actually don't, I think it's so much more nuanced than that, you know? So I just feel like in this moment right now, I was asked to do a play, and I was really excited to be working with, you know, people at an institution that I deeply respect, and to be given a chance to challenge, you know, perceptions of how we can do Shakespeare on stage with the certain kinds of people that we normally don't see playing these kinds of roles.
Right.
And I feel like that for me is the larger achievement.
So when we were talking, you guys touch on this today during the directing session of like being afraid of being pigeonholed. And I was thinking about that as you're talking about the, Bill Rausch asking you to direct a Shakespeare set in Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And like, but that's not the only thing you do.
That's not the only thing I do. Cause that can also flip the other way. Like if Bill didn't ask me, I'd be pissed. Right? Cause, right? I mean, that's, you can think of it like, well, how dare you think of me as an Asian director? But at the same time, if I wasn't asked, I'd be a little like, hey, wait a minute. How come I wasn't asked? Or at least I wasn't like considered. It's like what Evren said. Like if there's a Middle Eastern play, I better be on that short list.
Yeah.
You know? But at the same time, I mean, it's, you know, people will see you, for whatever value that they see you having. And when I was first starting out as a director, you know, I was thinking about Eric Ting, his experience, and he said, you know, he was grew up in, you know, in the Midwest, went to school in Tennessee,
yeah.
And largely felt like an other for a good chunk of his life. And I grew up in Southern California, huge Chinese population. I live in the Chinese community, so I never felt like an outsider until I got into the theater.
Mm-hmm.
So it was so strange for me to be working in a field that I felt so deeply connected to, like spiritually, and at the same time felt like didn't want me. And for a while I was like, oh, is it because I'm not good enough? Or is it because I'm not? And after a while I was like, oh, I just don't think that, I didn't know
what to do with you.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, oh, she does that. And I guess there is a legacy of Asian American theater. But that wasn't what I was taught. I was taught Shakespeare and Chekhov and mm-hmm. a lot of Eurocentric Western stuff.
Yeah.
And I loved doing it. And it was just so strange to feel like here's something that I love doing that for some reason I just can't seem to get into.
Yeah.
And so this idea of, I don't know, pigeonholed or not pigeonholed, you know, as I was starting off, you know, when I was first starting to direct in my 20s, I was always interested in classical work and sometimes new work, but
yeah.
Because I did a lot of reading of the classics in college, and we didn't do a lot of new play work when I was in college, because, you know, unless you have access to that kind of material or those writers, you're largely doing what the curriculum tells you, which is, you know, modern American, the Greeks, mm-hmm. right? Shakespeare. I knew that there was a community of other Asian American artists. But I never really fell into that. Cause I kept chasing Arthur Miller, you know? which was weird because it felt like, why am I not with my people? Why am I not reading like more of David Henry Hwang? Why am I not reading like Diana Sun? More of that. But I didn't. And for some reason, maybe it's because I'm just so stubborn, but if you want to get me to do something, tell me I can't do it. And you bet I will try my damnedest to do it, right? And I think because I felt so excluded, I was like, damn it, you know what? I'm going to do this. I will out American theater you, American theater, you know? And so for a while early on, I think looking back now, I'm kind of embarrassed that I did this, but I actually avoided working with a lot of Asian American writers because I didn't want to. I felt like, no, I'm going to get my foot in that white theater. I'm going to get in there. I'm going to figure it out. I'm going to prove to you that the training I had when I was in school is valid and that I belong in here too. I can do that Shakespeare. I can do it just as well as you can.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, you know, the Asians are like, Desmond, come play with us. I'm like, no, I'm not playing with you. I'm playing with the white kids.
Yeah.
You know?
I'm not ready for you yet. I have to be famous and go on Broadway before I can do
it. My mother said I had to go to Broadway. I mean, it's really, I wouldn't have been able to explain that at the time, but I feel like now it was just because I felt like I was chasing some perception of success that had to do with, an internalized desire to assimilate.
Yeah.
And it took a while, you know, because I knew that I would never have a problem being asked to do the Asian thing. I would always have a problem being asked to do the Eurocentric thing.
Yeah.
Right? And so, I mean, really.
It's still an issue, though, because it's just you and Eric. And who else, what other, like, I guess, director of color does classic work?
Right, classical work. May hasn't done classic work. She's done a lot of new play development work. Yeah, as far as Asian directors go, or directors of color.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, Joe Hodge is a fair amount.
Yeah, does Kenny Leon done, has he done some, or is it just August Wilson?
I don't know. I know that Kenny has a lot of, I haven't been tracking his career as heavily as I probably should be.
Right, but it's like a short list.
There is a short-ish list. Yeah, and I don't know what that is, you know, and I don't know whether if having a kind of like separatist philosophy is what led to it. And I think maybe it's just because where we are now in 2016 and this conversation around inclusivity, representation happened to be at, you know, the crossroads. All this stuff coming together at this time magically crystallized, you know, this ability for me to kind of seize upon the moment, to be able to get visibility in a way that I don't think I would have been able to if I was doing this in the 90s.
Right.
It's also like timing. And I also wonder, you know, like, is there an entire generation of Asian directors who just aren't doing it because they were just at the wrong time? And this conversation right now happening around diversity, inclusivity, hiring practices, fairness, equity, wasn't being talked about, right? And we've just been kind of unconsciously excluding directors of color because we never saw them that way, because we never had to see them that way, because no one was calling us out for not seeing them that way.
Yeah. Anyway, talk to me about The Crucible and at Playmaker. So that's what you're working on right now?
I am. I'm directing The Crucible down at Playmaker's Rep. Vivian Benish, who's the artistic director down there, invited me to come in. This is her kind of inaugural season, her first season, and it was kind of a real treat. Cause I always feel like whenever there's a change in the guard, it was like, oh no, is the new guard gonna like me, or am I going out with the old guard? You know?
I know, do I have to like remake these relationships, like buy them more drinks?
Right. And so luckily I had a chance to meet Vivian, and she's such a wonderful person, and we got along really well, and she said, you know, I would really love to have you do The Crucible. And I said, awesome, great. And I finally got my Arthur Miller. Yay! I did it. He's finally the match on my bedpost. Got it. Miller and Shakespeare in 1 year. Tick, tick. All right, Tennessee Williams, I'm after you next. I'm doing that right now, Playmakers. It's lovely. It's Playmakers is connected to the UNC Chapel Hill graduate program. So it's a combination of company actors, graduate actors, and a number of guest artists that we hire out of New York, and a number of local Triangle area actors.
Yeah, and they're resident too. Actors. They're resident
actors too.
I mean, and how, what's your treatment, and is it diverse? I haven't seen the cast list yet.
It is diverse-ish. It is diverse-ish because their current class of graduate students is a diverse cast. They have, you know, this incoming class, there are 3 African-American actors in this incoming class. And, you know, Vivian is committed to diversity and inclusivity and equity and all that. She's asking all the right questions. And she had talked to me about The Crucible and said, you know, I would really love to have a conversation around multicultural casting for this production. And I said, oh, but it's The Crucible, which is actually, I think, a little bit about white people. Actually, the play is about white people, and the kind of, you know, extremist behavior and otherness, and I make a multicultural? What's that going to be? Right. So, but you know, after some thinking, I was like, you know, again, it's what am I killing?
No, I mean, are the white people in your version killing the people of color? Is that what's happening, or how are you?
No, it's not. Yes, some, some, but we also have people of, right, so I'm also trying to be careful about not perpetuating a narrative where it's, where people of color are constantly the victims.
Mm-hmm.
So we have, you know, people of color playing, you know, some folks of color as the young girls. Mm-hmm. We have people of color, people of, and folks of Salem, and even the kind of, you know, when the deputy governor and the judges from Boston come in, we have a couple of folks of color in that production. But what I've done with it is, I've essentially moved the production to 2016.
Yeah.
And the play is about what happens. So the play for me is about how a crazy, kooky idea that happens far away that we don't think has anything to do with us can suddenly be on our doorsteps without realizing it, right? We thought Trump was so funny a year ago, and holy shit, now he's actually on the ballot. Mm-hmm. What? How did we get here? How did we get here? So that for me is what the play is. The play is about, oh, there's rumors of witchcraft. That's so crazy. These girls were dancing in the forest. Like, ha, 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 what? And because, you know, as ideas spread, how do extremist ideas go from a place of being crazy to being normal? And how do we get from a place of girls dancing in a forest to a system of government using execution as a means of maintaining order, right? Like, how is that possible? So those are the big questions I'm trying to answer with this production. And the kind of, you know, the gimmick, if there has to be a gimmick behind it, is that this is the play is set in 2016, but it's set in an isolated community, because the people of Salem, you know, in Miller's play, the Puritans, are a group of people who have left England, because they're persecuted, and they opted to live by themselves in an isolated community. Right. They're opting to live off the grid. So in our production, it is a group of people who've opted to live off the grid. Much like, you know, the Mennonites or the Hooderites. So we are throwing out bonnets and aprons in this production. This will be a production of bonnets and aprons. But then what happens is that halfway through the play, when the government intervenes, these people are taken out of their communities and pulled into the urban court system, the civic, you know, that like institutional system, right?
Yeah.
And we end up at the very end in prison, and suddenly we feel like it's Guantanamo. So in a way, like, the shorthand is we go from period to modern, but really we're modern the entire time. People, when I talk to the company about this, they're like, oh, it's like The Village. You know that movie by M. Night Shyamalan? I've never seen it. But they're saying, oh my god, it's like that. It's like, we thought we were in 1692, but we're actually in 2016. Holy crap, this whole time we thought we were in the past, but we're actually in today. So I guess it's like that.
So I guess that's the thing. Did you spoil the ending to your play?
I guess I did. Sorry, guys.
Well, I mean, that's also part of the reason that the Crucible is getting remounted so much now, because there is that kind of that feel the other hasn't really left our culture.
Yeah, yeah. It's a damn good script. My mm-hmm. God, Mr. Miller, kudos to you. It's a damn good script.
Yeah.
And you know, and also because it was just on Broadway, people were kind of like hubbubbing about it. You know, did you get a chance to see it?
No, I didn't have time.
I was quite taken by it. I was I mean, people had disagreements, but I thought it was a very stunning production, and captured a lot of what I thought was central to the play, i.e., fear and terror. My goodness, the way people are, you know, can be incited to do crazy things when they're governed by feelings and not by rationality. And if you know, if we're in a heightened state and adrenaline is what's driving us to make choices, we'll make some crazy ass choices and justify them because we're acting on intuition and instinct as opposed to rationality and you know, scientific methods. You know,
sounds familiar,
right?
Yeah,
right. Yeah, it's funny because I feel like right now it's a timely play, and there's this quote from Arthur Miller. You know, kind of, I think he made a joke, kind of half joking, not half joking, that whenever you saw the Crucible being done in a particular country, you could tell when a dictator was going to come into power. That's when you saw the crystal being done in that country?
Oh, shit.
I know. It's very alarming. We actually closed, and our
we're so close.
I know. And the production that we're doing at Playmakers, we actually closed 2 days before the election.
Right.
So we opened the 22nd, and we closed November, November 6th? When's the election? I don't know. 2 days before the election when we closed.
I don't know. Well, hopefully it's just a bad dream and not reality.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. We will see. Yeah. What else are you working on this season?
I am coming up. I'm going to be doing Smart People at Long Wharf,
mm-hmm.
which will be fun. I've never had a chance. I've my first time in New Haven, so I'll go out and visit New Haven. Yay. Gonna, ask what the good food places are out there. And then in summer of 2017, I'm doing As You Like It at Cal Shakes. And then the rest of the year, there are negotiations and murmurs up in the air.
Can't
disclose yet. But yeah.
Seems like a full schedule.
Yeah, I would try. You gotta pay the bills.
And we're back with some recommendations. I will just kick it off as briefly as I can to recommend a show that's not a stranger to anyone who's listened to this podcast, Queen Wen's Viet Gone, which is now at Manhattan Theater Club through November 28th. Deep spoke to Queen in a great podcast from last year after she saw it at the Pacific Playwrights Festival on early January, in early 2015, I believe, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it then has been playing at Oregon Shakespeare Festival, just closed last weekend. And that cast is going to do it at Seattle Rep.
They're awesome. So you should go see them.
Yeah. And the MTC cast is pretty damn great too. And I would just say that it's a play I'd read, had anticipated for a long time. I know Kui socially, through our kids, actually, even though he's now on the West Coast. We miss you, Kui. And you go see a friend's show. It's like, I hope it's good because I got to talk to him. And it's great. It's not just good. It's a great show. And it's a show. It's a great play, but it's also a show. Queen knows how to put on a show. He did those shows of Vampire Cowboys and just knows how to entertain the hell of a crowd. But he also had this story he wanted to tell about his parents, who were South Vietnamese refugees from Vietnam in 75, and they met at a refugee camp in Fort Chaffee, Arkansas. And he builds a lot of complication into what is, on its surface, kind of very irreverent comic book, slangy, hip-hop sort of romp, through this gnarly story of folks leaving a war zone and finding love and having different points of view toward their new home. I was thoroughly disarmed by it. I needed to be disarmed a little bit because I feel like our thinking went, as you said, Deep, when someone's telling a story about refugees and war and Vietnam, oh, it's going to be heavy. It's going to be, And the last scene of the play is a rather straightforward, although it's very funny as well, but it's a straightforward naturalistic scene where of a father and son. A lot of people are talking about that as if it's the whole play, and it is what lands the play, but it wouldn't work without the fun and the complication that comes before it. So I can't recommend it highly enough. I think it should be in, every theater should produce. It's only five actors, right? There's a lot of projections and set stuff to do, but it's and some fight choreography. Hire a good fight choreographer, but it's wonderful. It's it lives up to the hype.
Well, awesome. Because I was just talking on Twitter with some people about how this year's a great year for Vietnamese refugees or children of refugees reclaiming our narratives because, like you were saying, Rob, most of what people know about Vietnam is very much on the, Americans versus the Viet Cong.
Right.
And you expect anti-American sentiment from any Vietnamese person, but the reality is more complicated than that.
Yeah.
And so, the Pulitzer Prize winner for the novel this year was Viet Thanh Nguyen's The Sympathizer, which is about South Vietnamese fleeing Saigon and assimilating to America.
Right.
And so, go see Viet Gone and then read The Sympathizer, and you'll get, two polar opposite, well, not opposite, but, two polar opposite, yeah, different tones.
Different styles.
Different styles of how to tell a Vietnamese-American story. So.
Yeah, good range.
Very good range.
And Kui's writing more in this vein, right? He's more writing more of his family story, which I've heard bits and pieces of over the years, and I can't wait to see it, turned inside out into a crazy comic book show.
There's ample drama there. He's told me,
yeah,
about them.
Right. Which is one reason. So it's, I mean, I could take that drama probably, but it's great to have someone with his sensibility kind of, again, turn it inside out, turn it upside down. You were going to recommend.
Yes. Last week I was listening to Rob interview Lynn Nottage, and I was just so inspired and bedazzled by hearing her speak just so eloquently about these topics that have been coming up sporadically in this election, but not nearly enough, which is about, you know, economic stagnation and about, I mean, the characters in the, in her newest play, Sweat, we don't know if they're Trump supporters.
Few of them probably would be, yeah.
Yeah, but it's interesting but there's been so much in talk in this election about the deplorables, the people in the basket, but not about the other people who are voting for Trump, which are the people who felt like disenfranchised by the government, who feel abandoned because nothing's been done to help them, you know, like get jobs and all the industries that were the boon of these small towns in America. Like, they've all left because they've all moved overseas because of, you know, NAFTA and similar free trade laws. So it's just, well, and the Nodge's newest play, Sweat, currently playing at the Public Theater, is about that and takes a really micro view at the small town Reading, Pennsylvania. And I just really found it so powerful because not only does it talk about economic stagnation among poor white people, it's also about among black people and also among Latinos, uh-huh. and the intersectionality of that and what happens when you, like, what happens when, like, a culture is of unions and of like generations working at this factory is disrupted. And also the racism that is usually tied into that because of those conflicts. I recommend that. And then after you do that, watch the Black Jeopardy sketch on SNL from last week with Tom Hanks. And they kind of have a similar theme of how, you know, poor people of different ethnicities, we have more in common than we have differences.
Right, right. Russ?
Quickly, I will recommend Duat, the new play by Daniel Alexander Jones, running at the Connolly Theater. It's a Soho Rep production. And it's a really great piece about coming of age as a queer person of color. And I believe it's a cast of all black performers, mm-hmm. and it's life affirming but nuanced. You get Daniel Alexander Jones in the first act talking a lot about his experience, and then Jomama Jones comes in as directing a pageant in the second act, which is full of a lot of really cool music, and it's just a great piece.
Sounds great. I've heard a lot about it. I would just quickly tease, you noticed that all three of our recommendations were for New York shows. Now, Sweat's been at Arena Stage and Oregon Shakes, and Viet Gong's been everywhere. Duat might go elsewhere. But I really feel like we should broaden our perspective and get a recommendation from outside of New York. And so I'm initiating a new feature called Critical Check-In. And my first one is with Lily Janik, the relatively new critic at San Francisco Chronicle.
So I saw this play called Our Enemies, Lively Scenes of Love and Combat by Yusuf Al-Gwindi, and it was at a theater called Golden Thread Productions. So that I found out recently, I should have known this before, but they are the first company in the United States to be founded dedicated to stories and people and artists and concerns of the Middle East. The very first, and they're right out here in San Francisco. So they were founded in 96. And this play, I started to read it before I went, which I do sometimes. And when I finished the first scene, I decided I couldn't read anymore because it was so dangerous feeling just on the page. And there was such a wonderful surprise that I didn't want to spoil anymore for myself. It's about how the American media represents Arab Americans. And it just discusses that complex issue with, like, all the complexity it deserves. It's, like, every single line adds a new shade of nuance to the issue. And, like, this isn't even really a story I see represented on American stages much. I finished writing, like, this rave review, and usually I kind of struggle and have to force myself to write, but I, like, finished ahead of deadline. Has any writer ever heard of such a thing? And, like, I went over my word count and finished ahead of deadline. It's insane. And I'm just so thrilled about this show. I want everyone in the Bay Area to go see it, and wherever it goes next, you should all go see it, too.
I hope you enjoyed the show, and like us on Facebook, you know, rate us on iTunes, and thanks for listening.